I'm here. It's also your
There we go.
Yeah, it's also your birthday.
It is also my birthday, so I'm not here. I'm off. We had Thanksgiving yesterday, as you know. Mm-hmm. Yesterday was Thanksgiving. And it's so weird when we usually do the show live. The vast majority of people watch it or listen to it recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really have to say any of this.
But we have to be honest. We have to be honest with our audience. They might be able to tell.
How was your Thanksgiving?
It was great.
Really?
Yeah. No family drama.
Really?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. None.
Who did you have your Thanksgiving with?
Well, my husband's side of the family. So
okay, that's why there was no drama.
That's exactly why. Yes.
You avoided your own family.
Yep.
And were your parents upset that you didn't come to their Thanksgiving?
Well,
or did they understand?
Not to get too into it, but they're divorced, so I already have to deal with that and two-front battle. And now my in-laws, though, are very easy, and it's just the alternating thing. So
things were pretty casual.
I'm hoping I'm manifesting this situation, yes.
Right, because we're actually recording this a couple of days before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you made that clear, right? Yep. But if anyone else wants to hear about my family history and, anything else...
I would hate to see you interrogated.
I would fold so quickly.
And Brian has been on several occasions.
Without a doubt.
I mean, I am not into poker, and that's probably a good thing.
I could tell you, mine was an absolute show. My Thanksgiving.
Your Thanksgiving.
Yesterday.
Yes.
Which is actually in the future.
Right.
There's always drama.
But your birthday is going to be even better, because what are you going to do? Go get trampled at the Target or something in a TV?
No, I don't. exactly. I'm going to
get a microwave,
and I'm going to get into a fight over a microwave. It really works well on Black Friday, because I say it's my birthday.
Yes.
And then everybody stands down.
Everyone's very nice after that.
Does anybody go shopping on Black Friday anymore?
Or
is it all just
so.
People just like order to get the sale? I wait for Cyber Monday.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, that's
no,
the way
I don't
to go.
Do any of that stuff. Probably today, my kids pretended that it's my birthday, and therefore we're going to do whatever Dad wants, and that lasts for about 15 minutes. That's probably what we want. Yeah. So it's nice.
Wrap up an apple for you.
Exactly. The first 15 minutes are great, and then it just all falls apart. So we'll see. But I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving and enjoy these interviews. We will be talking to Maureen Tachik, and Gino Rady will be interviewing the new deputy mayor, Dean Fulahan, in a moment. Just a word from one of our sponsors today. Our favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeSebade.com. Friends at Sunset Lake know that it's easy, or I should say, it's not always easy to feel thankful these days because, well, frankly, the country's in, I don't want to say a death spiral, but...
Yeah, there's some rough stuff going on.
It's been better. So they wanted to extend their thanks to this show, our amazing listeners, and obviously always to Brian for maintaining their entire lifted tea industry.
You're welcome.
They've been able to, they ramped up production. They were able to buy another factory to make the lifted tea.
To buy another factory?
Another factory just for the amount of lifted tea that Brian drinks.
State of Vermont.
Exactly.
Owes me.
45,000 people are being employed to provide Brian lifted tea. Actually, the lifted tea is amazing. I will tell you this. I'm actually recording this before Thanksgiving, but my plan is have two of those and be completely out of it throughout all of Thanksgiving.
That sounds amazing.
Yes. Holidays are coming up. It's that time of year, less daylight, colder temperatures, a little extra stress. As we wind down 2025, you deserve an opportunity to rest and recharge. And thankfully, our friends at Sunset Lake have kicked off their Black Friday sale. Right now, you can save 30% site-wide when you head to SunsetLakeSebade.com. Use the code FRIDAY25. That's the word Friday, the numbers 25, no spaces. They got everything you need to chill out. They got smokables. They got keef and pre-rolls. They've got tinctures for your pets. They've got tinctures that help you sleep. Same with gummies. Gummies to help you sleep or just chill out, or gummies with a little THC to make you have a little more fun. They've got Sebadeh coffee and Sebadeh fudge. They've got lotions. All of their stuff is grown without pesticides, all using regenerative farming practices. These guys are a great movement partner. They've donated tens of thousands of dollars to strike relief funds, to carceral reform, to refugee resettlement, to food pantry. They just donated $5,000 to the Vermont Food Pantry. Just on and on and on. They have been great partners over the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years of this program. Maybe more, actually, at this point. But they're giving you 30% off with the code Friday25, as in Friday, Black Friday, 2025. And if you spend over $125, Sunset Lake will throw in a free citrus-flavored 750 milligrams Sebadeh tincture. Head over to sunsetlakesebadeh.com. Use the code Friday25. Save on 30% on their wellness products for people and pets. The sale ends December 1st. I think that's Monday at 11:59 p.m. So see their full site, their site for full terms and conditions. Check it out. Also, as always, your support makes this show possible. If you want to help us survive and thrive and get the show commercial free, go to jointhemajorityreport.com. All right. When we come back, Maureen Tassick, investigative editor at The Prospect and senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project, writing about the scam that is piggybacking the ACA, particularly in states like Texas and Florida that have booted a bunch of people off of Medicaid. And then Gino Rady will be interviewing the New York City's deputy mayor, Dean Fulahan, and you can check out Gino's blog on Substack. All right. Enjoy the show, and we'll see you on Monday. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure for me to welcome back to the program a writer at the American Prospect and reporter, Maureen Tassick, is with us. And Maureen has written a piece. This is important because right now we are weeks away from the last opportunity the Congress will have to extend the Obamacare subsidies that were additional subsidies that were put in place during COVID. And right now, people on the Affordable Care Act exchanges are looking at potential increases of up to 115% in their premiums, which is both a function of the loss of subsidies and the subsequent or contingent increase in prices by the insurance companies, because they are anticipating losing subscribers to their insurance and their shrink pools shrinking. Maureen, let's talk about, I mean, you're writing this piece to show like sort of the abuse of these systems, but let's talk a little bit first with sort of like the broad strokes here that we have. Remind us about like the development of the Affordable Care Act and how it works.
So, put simply, the Affordable Care Act it created this supposed marketplace. You know, in neoliberalism, we always have to create the illusion of markets, even where nothing resembling a market really exists. And so they created this pseudo marketplace. I really don't know. You know, they created, I think, 10 categories of healthcare that you needed to treat if you wanted to be, you know, an ACA, an Affordable Care Act certified marketplace insurer. And these were primarily designed for people who are between employment, self-employed, Uber drivers, small businesses, anybody who couldn't get an insurance policy before, and they weren't on the marketplace, sadly, not
through their employer.
Right. Who couldn't get insurance through normal means, through their employer or through, you know, Medicaid or what have you. And it subsidized those plans pretty liberally up to 400% of the poverty line. And beyond 400% of the federal poverty line, which when the ACA passed was around $40,000, $42,000 a year for a single person. Now it's around $62,000 a year for a single person. You got nothing. And that was, but you did get a chance to buy insurance if if you had a pre-existing condition, which was something that had been extremely difficult for, there had been years of stories basically about self-employed or small businesses, small business owners who would have a child who had a rare disease and had to go work as a cable guy, just to get insurance for their kid. I've read tons of stories about this was a huge problem. Right now, the problem, and I want to say I will correct something. A lot of people are going to be seeing 300% increases in their premiums. When I it, and this is if you are in that 401 plus percent of the federal poverty line income bracket, and that is for a family of four, it's $128,000. If you make $129,000 or $132,000, in 19 states, your premiums are gonna triple,
Okay.
and that's insane.
How
Like,
is now how is
that
that
is
going about?
insane.
And I just want to like just remind people that there were really three major components, broadly speaking, to the Affordable Care Act. The actual name of the bill, people refer to it now as Obamacare, was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So there was a whole host of stuff that were patient protections. Like you say, no rescission, no lifetime caps, no annual caps. You can stay on your policy to your 26. There was actually a list of things that actually qualified it to be considered real insurance, as opposed to like sort of scammy insurance that really didn't necessarily support you. The other part was the expansion of Medicaid, which the Supreme Court said was optional for states. And I think we were close to, I don't know, 80, 90% of the states have expanded Medicaid since then. Many of those Republican holdouts succumbed to the pressure. And then what we're talking about is the exchanges, which dealt with, I think at the time, close to 40 million people who were not eligible either for Medicare or Medicaid. We're not getting it from their union, like you say, or their workplace. And so this is what we're talking about specifically, that tranche of people. And so why is it that if you're at 401% of poverty, you could be looking at 300% increases in insurance? Obviously, I didn't know that.
So that is because that is how expensive these ACA plans have gotten. And I don't know, I have to, I've been meaning to do some historical research on just what the average plan was at the beginning, because I've been told that there are certain very high cost states. West Virginia is one, very unhealthy. Vermont is one, possibly because they're across, the border from Canada. People are doing their own sort of arbitrage. Alaska, everything is expensive in Alaska, so that's another one. And I think Arkansas is one of them. But there are a few of these states where it's just ludicrous. It's like close to $4,000 unsubsidized for a month for a family of four. So we're talking about and just an enormous chunk of change. I mean, this is
That's if
more
you
than a
make
lot of
like
people.
$129,000, you're talking about
For a family of four, yeah.
4,000 of post-tax dollars. That's you need to make I don't know what the tax rates are in those specific states, but you're talking about making like 60,000 plus maybe to just pay for, that's half of your salary. That's half of the income that your family is generating.
And yes, and in unlike the way that we do progressive taxation in terms of taking, the bracket only grows for the incremental you know, amount of income that you take in over the cap, it's not like that at all. So there's a, I'm sure there are probably a lot of people saying, okay, you know, number one, and this has been sort of a problem that's plagued the institution from the beginning. You know, you have people with good accountants who say, well, you know, I only made $4 in income last year, because that's how, you know, rich people do it. And you know, there have been stories that have been circulated by right-wing think tanks for over a decade now of, you know, the millionaire real estate investor who got on Medicaid, you know, or got on an ACA plan with no premium because of this system. But basically, if you're a normal person, if you're an Uber driver or whatever, you're going to be driving less, you know, you're going to be doing whatever you can, you know, maybe quit your job to see, to try and bring back your income back down. So in 2021, after, you know, the pandemic, and the CARES Act made a lot of changes in just the way that healthcare, the way that COVID was going to be covered. And at that point, the insurance companies were very flush because people were not doing any elective surgeries. They weren't really going to the doctor. They weren't getting in car accidents. They were pretty boring lives, except for the COVID part. And those that was covered by the government pretty strictly. They added new subsidies to Obamacare, and they eliminated that threshold and that of 400%. And they just said, listen, regardless of your income, we are going to cap the amount that you have to pay out of pocket for your premiums at 8.5% of your income. And that is why so many people at that $128,000 income range are going to see their costs, you know, go up 300-400%, because that is their costs were capped at 8.5% before. So it's a really wild way. I don't know, you know, who thought of this whole means testing program before. But there were also subsidies that were added to, those are the people who are really, really freaking out right now. Self-employed, small business, on the Obamacare plan and you know, making $150,000. Those are the folks who are really going to see the worst of this this subsidy cliff.
And we should say $150,000, the family is making that.
Yes, the family. If you are a single person on Obamacare, this is $63,000 we're talking about is your cap. So, you know, it is not a lot of money. especially in a lot of these states where the costs are very high. And at the same time, though, this the American Rescue Act is the legislation that extended that you know, boosted the subsidies, and it ended up boosting the subsidies dramatically. But it added a boost into those subsidies at all levels. So if you were up to 200% of the poverty level, you were eligible for a zero premium plan, a silver plan. And sorry, my husband keeps calling me. I need to just turn this off because, long story. But so they added a whole lot of premiums at every income level, and where the insurance companies really got excited was at that lower end income level, because it's not too hard to sell somebody on an insurance policy that is completely free.
Right.
And so what they were doing is, in a lot of these states, is going to very low income people. And in a lot of these cases, in Florida and Texas, which are non-Medicaid expansion states, they had all been barred by the CARES Act, I believe, from kicking enrollees off Medicaid during the public health emergency. So that was until 2023. They were really itching to kick some people off Medicaid. And Florida ended up in, you know, 2023 and 2024, kicking close to 2 million people off their Medicaid rolls. These are already, you know, very, very limited rolls. And so they would, you know, find these people who were on Medicaid or were, you know, they
These
were
are
Medicaid eligible.
insurance company brokers, essentially.
Right. Brokers or street teams hired by these brokers.
And
the brokers are really not supposed to do this.
They have this new sort of like reservoir of potential customers, as it were. All these people kicked off of Medicaid who are desperate for health insurance, but have really no means in which to pay it. So if you're selling them something, you're selling them something which is going to be fully subsidized. It's basically an opportunity for a sort of a win-win for everybody. Maybe not so much the taxpayer, but
right.
That's part of it. And so then what happens?
So yeah, and not again, a lot of these people didn't have any idea what they were offered. In this case, there was this little boiler room called Fiorella Insurance Agency, owned by it was purchased during the course of this fraud by the private equity firm GTCR, which is a big Chicago private equity fund whose principal is the former Illinois governor Rauner. That's the R in GTCR, but they're huge in healthcare. So this agency was going to bus stops and homeless shelters and motels and basically bribing people with booze and gift cards to sign up for their Obamacare plans. And to do this, they would have to actually, because before 2023, they would have to go through a long series because Medicaid wasn't actually supposed to be kicking people off the rolls. So you had to work pretty hard to get the administrator to agree to kick you off the rolls. You had to sort of, supply falsified income statements or say that, you had made a turn for the better. And these are people who are living in homeless shelters or people who are living in motels, say, no, you are about to come into a lot of money and you simply didn't qualify anymore. But they were doing that because they were getting if you sell these policies, you get a commission of up to $30 per month for the year per enrollee. So if you sell, a household of four, that's a chunk of change. I think it's like over $1,000.
So an outfit like Fiorella would actually do all the paperwork to say this person's no longer eligible for Medicaid. They get bumped off. Then they sell this product on the exchanges to the customer. They get the fee. Does the customer even know that they have health insurance at that point? Do they use the health insurance? Or, I mean, because it seems to me like if it's just a matter of like, okay, this person was booted off of Medicaid, which happened in Florida and Texas, like you say, and the person needs health insurance, I'm just functioning as like a community advisor. Like that's what, when ACA launched, they were like these sort of entities that were NGOs that were paid to help connect people with the Affordable Care Act. But that's not all of it, right? I mean, they get them on the exchange.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
What happens, and there's all kinds of variations on this scam. This was the scam where they go, find homeless people, poor people, and convince them to, bribe them into switching their insurance. And for the most part, those people did know that their insurance had changed. They thought that it wasn't going to make a difference. Their treatment ended up getting disrupted. There's another class of scam where, that's much more deceptive, where they were getting, random people to watch videos and enter in information. And then these people were finding when they went to get care that they'd actually been kicked out of their insurance. And some of these people had commercial insurance policies and they were finding out that they were enrolled in the ACA. CMS actually had last year 200,000 complaints about this very type of fraud. So this was a fraud that was really, ubiquitous in the country. And again, when you look at the numbers, in 2020, we had 11 million Americans on ACA plans. In 2025, that number is close to 25 million. So you saw enormous growth. The majority of that growth, probably 57% of it, is three states, Florida, Texas, non-Medicaid expansion states, and Georgia, also a non-Medicaid expansion state, Marjorie Taylor Greene's backyard. That is where that growth was happening. And a lot of it was happening at the hands of this company called Centene. Their stock is up today on the idea that the Trump might extend these subsidies. They're up 6%. It's been a very bad year for Centene. And they are sort of like this stealth United Healthcare. They're this giant, but they deal only with, you know, they almost, you know, wholly with sort of poorer populations. So they run healthcare in prisons and jails, and they administer Medicaid in a bunch of states. They do a lot of dirty tricks. They put
we
private
know how
investigators.
Much, okay, so if we've seen a doubling, and that was to be anticipated, actually, one and a half times, I guess, or actually 2.5 times. What we had in terms of the Affordable Care Act enrollment, that was anticipated. There was a sense that more people are going to get on there. But do we have a sense of, and I get the fact that like there was this sort of cost shift from the public, ostensibly public Medicaid, where incidentally the costs are about 2 to 3% in terms of administrative costs. So the costs are much lower for someone to get Medicaid insurance. Onto the private system, but which is now fully subsidized by the government. So it's just a more costly, inefficient way of providing government-sponsored health insurance, essentially. Do we know how much of that increase in those three states, you said 57%, because of that push people off of Medicaid into the ACA? But do we know how much of that is like fraudulent and like that people were guided off of Medicaid even though they were still eligible for Medicaid into the exchanges?
No, I have no idea how, you know, it would be difficult to quantify that because without doing I think a pretty, you know, serious survey of folks. And again, these are non-Medicaid expansion states. But when you look at how the numbers changed over the composition of the people on ACA plans changed over that 2020 to 2025 period, you see certain, you know, substantial shifts. Number one, you saw, of course, an explosion in the number of people who made, you know, 401% plus over the poverty line, because there were a ton of people for whom, you know, insurance just went from, you know, not making sense or working at Starbucks to get your insurance to, oh, okay, you know, I can actually do this.
Because there's a cap of 8.5% of my income on this. And so it's
right.
Affordable now for us. Okay.
And the majority of those people, the vast majority of those people are white. At the same time, however, even still, even with this explosion at the top end of the income stream, you saw the ACA go from a majority white, you know, I think 58% of the enrollees were white, to now it's like 51%. So you saw a real focus on recruiting minority lower income patients. You also saw the premium, the average or median premium just plummet. So at all of these, you know, income brackets, you would see, I think that, you know, even like among Latinos, I saw like the average premium go from, you know, $65 to $20. And part of that is because of the subsidies. And part of that is because they're bringing new Latinos into the programs and they're selling them on whatever kind of zero premium plan they can. So that was the other thing that that shifted. And when you sell a zero premium plan too, then, you know, you can so much more easily do that fraudulently because the enrollee does not know until they try to access their health care that it's happened. So it's there's been, when you look at the numbers, you look at the growth in these three critical states, you see, because, you know, you see a state like California and where California ACA enrollment changed there was mostly at the top end. It is really these three states, and that's where Centene is really a super dominant force, especially in Texas. You saw these boiler rooms selling these plans and doing kind of whatever they had to do to get people on the program. And this is, of course, illegal, but
Wait,
one
why
thing
is it
that
illegal? What is the illegal part?
well the most illegal the when the recipient is qualified for Medicaid, that is with if you're coaching, and which
Okay.
these this particular boiler room was doing, the coaching of enrollees to provide fraudulent information to the authorities to qualify for X, Y, and Z policy, that's a crime. Then there was conspiracy and money laundering. There were some yachts purchased with some of these ill-gotten gains. I spoke to an agent from who had worked at Fiorella, and she said that they had used her. They were using the licenses of agents who had left long before. Most of the people selling these policies were not licensed, insurance sales persons. You're not supposed to go out with insurance sales. You're not actually supposed to go out and recruit the patients. So they would hire these street teams, but there's like a real gray area of illegality there. But fundamentally, when you allow an insurance company to pay commissions to brokers, which is, this is a huge problem in Medicare Advantage
Advantage.
too, an enormous problem. And you allow also the insurance companies to provide all of these incentives, whether it's gift cards, free groceries, in this case it's booze and probably drugs. That is, but the gift cards is legal. That is, that's obviously going to create a perverse incentive. Why
Right.
are these commissions allowed?
Well, this is the problem writ large, and this is largely the point of your piece, is that we have incentive structures built into our healthcare system that are completely inefficient in terms of like the end goal of providing people with healthcare. And it ends up just enriching people, some of whom are like on a range of completely fraudulent and criminal, up to like just completely unnecessary in the process. At one point, you wrote, you were talking about costs, and this is it. And when you say why prices are expensive in Vermont is because a big chunk of the risk pool goes up to Canada to get better health care. Doesn't the right to buy health insurance lose a bit of its luster if said insurance costs $3,700 a month for a family of four, as it will next year in Vermont, West Virginia, and Alaska, for families of four with household incomes over $128,000? Across the border in Canada, citizens pay over $9,100 per person per year to fund their whole entire national health system. In 2025, American taxpayers paid $11,352 per person per year to subsidize the private insurance policies of Vermont ACA enrollees, who themselves pay an additional $11,000 per year per household to cover their premiums, to say nothing of co-pays and deductibles. So, in other words, this same family will pay in Canada $9,100 per person versus $22,000 per person in terms of the cost associated one in one way or another for their health care. And the gist of this is that all of this sort of like rent seeking, and that runs from rent seeking to fraud with this industry, we are now looking, as this system is getting super, super creaky. I mean, whatever Donald Trump comes out with, I think he's announced it this week, to the extent that we have any details on it, and it's possible to get this through a Republican Congress. And to the extent that it ends up actually providing health insurance as opposed to like a tax-free savings account for some people, is just the most inefficient, expensive way to do this. It's just that we have incumbent insurance providers And frankly, some health care providers who benefit from this system are making a ton of money at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are certain kinds of healthcare providers who are totally making bank. The average physician, no, they hate it and they hate Obamacare. And there's, you know, many, many other reasons for that because of the, you know, the mostly the data requirements. But yeah, the system is asinine. We knew it when it passed. You know, I was a grown up in 2009. When you know, they rat fucked the public option, and this is something also I remember, Larry Summers was deeply involved. He hadn't been involved in the ACA debate, and then, you know, at the last minute he comes out and says, "No, you know, we have to go back to square one because I've been talking to the pharma lobbyists, and they don't like this, that, and the other thing." So, you know, he was involved, you know. But, you know, Joe Lieberman was the guy, you know, threatened to filibuster if the plan, if it had a public option. And you know, it was one of those things that happened 2009, 2010, that made me realize that, you know, the Democrats were almost as bad as the other guys. But it was completely predictable. And I think that now how it's played out has been, you know, there are certain, like, there's so many different ways that the big companies have milked Obamacare's loopholes and its fine print to just make extraordinary sums. But your average physician hates it, is making less money, is seeing more patients. And so every, you know, they're really torn as well. I know extremely, you know, liberal pro Obamacare primary care physicians who say, you know, look, I can't tell my patient to pay $3,000 a month for a policy, you know, in good conscience. Like, it doesn't make sense. I'm gonna have to try and teach my patients how to, you know, how to survive as uninsured people. Yes. And we're going to see, you know, we are going to see more junky policies. But one thing about Centene is that, you know, this is the biggest ACA insurer. Their policies are called Am Better. And they, I mean, these are not real policies. This is the other thing, is just that ACA policies were supposed to provide some minimum threshold of care. They were supposed to be, okay, this is a legit insurance policy. When you look at their reviews online, you look at, you know, everything Uber drivers have ever said about this kind of insurance, you realize they just...
The patient protection part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act has also failed in many respects. Well, listen, we've got to run. But the bottom line, I think, is, and you make this piece point at the end of the piece, is that we're going to have a complete sort of like wreckage of the Affordable Care Act outside of the expansion of Medicaid to the extent that it's happened in different states, and to some degree with the patient protections that have largely been okay, although we see it on the lower ends, not so successful. And there's going to be both a sort of like political and material reasons to essentially reapproach this whole system and replace it with something that is rational. And it feels like they've run out of options. And by they, I mean everybody who wanted to support this. Like, we saw during COVID when Pelosi would not allow for an expansion of Medicare, which of course would have like brought new people into Medicare. And instead, they subsidized COBRA for people who had lost their jobs, which is literally the most expensive version of health insurance until now, maybe, that existed. Like, COBRA was where you're paying both the employer and the employee side, and the government decided to pay for all of it. So if I'm receiving it, it's great, it's free. But in terms of the efficiency of government, it was the least possible efficient way to do this. And they're so desperate to avoid the obvious answer, which is expand Medicare. expand Medicaid. Just allow, instead of one third of Americans on it, we allow
an outlaw Medicare Advantage. I mean, that's the other thing, you know, and it just reminds me so much because the same guys who were so pro Obamacare, the wonks that were selling it to us day in, day out in their blogs, are now the same people preaching abundance. And abundance says you can shower subsidies on housing developers and you can, you know, get rid of all the red tape and we will find an abundance of affordable housing. And it's a lie. It's not true.
It's, you know? I mean, to be honest with you, it is also the same theory that is associated with the way that the Obama administration dealt with the financial and housing crisis. You had two options. One option was you pay the money to the people who owe the bank and they pay the bank off and the bank gets made whole and that person gets made whole like FDR did, or you subsidize the banks and hope they do the right thing. And the fact is that in the private market, the incentives are not aligned with getting the most efficient delivery of all these products. It is make a profit first and foremost. Mo Tasek, thanks so much for your time today. We're going to link to your piece in the American Prospect in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thanks again, Mo. Appreciate it.
Have a great evening.
Dilfehan, thank you so much for coming on the Majority Report today.
So, Gino, thank you for having me. I'm really, it's a privilege being here with you, and I know we have a lot to talk about. We can start with, you pronounced my name and the way it is pronounced in Lebanon. And we're here, it's full of hand. It's an interesting distinction between being there and how it's pronounced, but thank you for that.
Fleihan for anyone who's listening. Correct. And I'm lucky, my name is easily recognized, my family name, so Raide can just be Raide.
He's trying to figure out. Well,
there's the Ayn at the end there, but yes. Raide is very
Raide easy. Is.
So I don't have, it's much easier for me, thankfully. I told Sam and Emma that I wanted to do the interview with you, because obviously we share something in common, which is that we're both Lebanese immigrants. So what would you tell the Arab and Lebanese community here, especially young Arabs and Lebanese who want to serve, but haven't seen a lot of people in leadership positions like that?
So it's a wonderful question. And the Zohran Mamdani campaign really personifies what's possible. It's both about the immigrant community. And actually, when he announced me, I spoke about my immigrant heritage. It's his message. So affordability, but also hope, and representing all the communities in New York City, the communities that have felt left out. It speaks to, I think we would both agree, it speaks to the Lebanese community, it speaks to the Arab community, it speaks to the Muslim community, but it also speaks to all New Yorkers. Because and we saw that, right? We saw an outpouring of support for the mayor-elect now, for Zohran Mamdani. We saw a level of support that was unprecedented. And an excitement, and people who never felt they were part of the system and now part of that system. That is a message we want, and it wasn't a message that stopped on election day. So the other thing I would tell them is we need to keep this going. We need continued support. We need support for that imperative, that affordability agenda. We need support so that Albany understands we need that support and Washington understands that this is something the community of New York needs to succeed and prosper. So we want their continuing involvement, and he is certainly a role model for Lebanese and Arab and much broader to continue to be active in our in our politics. And to the extent I can participate in that and encourage that, we want to. Because it's not a natural thing for, I mean, there are members of our community who are involved, but it's not always a natural
thing. Exactly. It's not as obvious.
But I have a feeling in our backgrounds that in my family, and I, there was always a discussion of politics and what was happening in Lebanon and the Middle East. And we also, I still have family in Lebanon. We sort of had a direct tie because my family had a long history with American University of Beirut.
That's my alma mater.
And it's your alma mater. And we had a strong tie with students coming at that time where I grew up in Syracuse, New York, of students coming. And that was, and they were all over, I mean, it's Lebanon. They were all over the political spectrum. From
different sects.
Oh my gosh! But even when they were from the same religion, they could be diametrically opposed. And of course, you would fight over the politics. And fortunately, you would have a lovely meal, which I do love our food.
I just arrived. Also.
And that added to okay, but we have cultural identity that hopefully holds us together.
You mentioned something that I think is very unique for Zohran's campaign, where a lot of times when politicians get to the position they were running for, the movement that kind of got them there is forgotten. And during this transition period, it's been clear that has been different. Can you explain to us what is the transition period exactly? Because in most places, it doesn't usually take a few weeks or a few months for administrations to shift. And how people can help during this transition?
So, the transition goes from the election day in November to January 1st. So January 1st, we take office. It is an enormous undertaking. It's a vibrant, huge city. It's the center of so many things in the United States. And it has so much responsibility. Everybody talks about 300,000 employees. If we add things that people don't talk about, like health and hospice, the biggest public health system in the country, it's the biggest public hospital system in the country. When you add that and our housing, you get up to about 370,000 employees that we have to give direction to and make sure that the day-to-day operations of the city are occurring and the policy agenda is occurring. But while we're also doing that, we need that same excitement, that same energy. And you're seeing the mayor-elect, you're seeing Zohra Mamdani out there all the time. You're even seeing me out there doing press stuff, which is not something I would normally do. So because the message is so important and we need community support to accomplish that message. So we want people to stay involved. We've received 50,000 resumes that we have to go through and make sure.
All of them.
Thank you so much.
Some tabbouleh.
Tabbouleh and nasiri and hummus. We were perfect.
The staples.
Yes.
Sahtin.
So do you, and who cooks in your household? Or
My mom. I'm lucky enough that my mom is here. Okay. So I love her cooking, but I dabble a bit, especially in kimbeh. Because that's what my town is like really known for. So I made sure before leaving Lebanon that I made my great aunt teach me our like recipe. So
excellent.
I can actually kibbeh aras, the one famous in Zelta.
It's very the large kibbeh.
I actually learned that.
Oh my God.
This is
so you have to make that for her.
I would love to. It would be an honor.
So I make tabbouleh every week.
Tabbouleh is great.
I have to make it every week.
If you,
and the bread is beautiful,
the fresh bread.
So I interrupted us with the food.
I think it's so much nicer to have it, and it'll remind you of when you used to go to Lebanon and have these conversations. You mentioned the hundreds of thousands of employees here. Someone with your experience, both in Albany and City Hall in New York City, what's something you'd like people to know about the New York City budget that they might not know about? Like how it works.
So the the for me, and I've obviously spent a lot of years doing budgets, and I can talk about the technicalities of the budget. And the current administration put out on a new financial plan yesterday, and it's $118 billion. So it's like an enormous undertaking. But what it really is, it's about we're gonna be responsible, right? But it's also the budget is the document that says here are the priorities of the city of New York, here are the priorities of the mayor. And when we start in January 1st, we have 1 month to put out our budget. In between, there'll be a state budget, and we hope to partner with the governor and the governor's team to do some of these major affordability issues to get them going. Yeah. So the budget really is, it's a measure of what we stand for. It's the priorities we want. It says these are the principles we stand for. It is the policy document of this administration. So we're going to take what came through that campaign. We're going to take what the voters supported and what they still see as necessary for the success of this city and that affordability agenda. And you're going to see it reflected in the budget.
Right?
It's got
flowers,
it.
Too.
Got it.
And it could be.
All right. So I think we have to dig in.
You should, yes, please. Lee Sahtin.
Thank you so much. And you have to start with Taboola, right?
All of them, of course. A bit, some refreshing Taboola.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to let you hand me a bra. Just give me. It's, thank you.
I like when they're nice and warm and fresh.
Oh, it's beautiful. Are you going to have, you have to have surprise.
Yeah, please feel free. So we talked about the budget. What's a priority you think can happen quick where regular working class New Yorkers can feel the impact of what that's going on?
So we have to, it's a very ambitious agenda. And everywhere you go, someone is going to tell you it can't be done.
Yeah.
That it's not realistic, that Albany won't do the corridor, they won't raise taxes, Washington will do something to us, there'll be a Medicaid crisis, something will happen. That's can't be the understanding. The understanding is that he ran on an agenda that said you're going to see change and you're going to see it immediately and you're going to see it in that budget. And yes, some things will take time to implement, but the commitment has to be big. And to the question of is it possible, I keep saying this to everyone, I can't name the number of times I've been told or other people have been told that's not possible.
Not feasible, yeah.
And then 3 months later, it happened. You know, I was honored to be part of the de Blasio administration. And in that first year, one of the things everybody wants, right, is universal pre-K for four-year-olds. And at the time, I'll never forget the department said, you can't, this takes 5 years. Right, there's no way to do it sooner. The governor at the time, Andrew Cuomo, can't do it. Do it, but it's not happening. No one's going to pay this. Don't do
it. Yeah.
Don't do it. Okay, it was 3 months later. It's in the state budget. The state's funding it, and we enacted it in 2 years. If government can do things, progressives, Democrats, socialists, that agenda can be done. And the agenda that Zohra Mamdani outlined is doable, and we have to make that happen. And I don't perceive the same roadblocks everybody else. I don't believe it. Yeah. We have to find, there's always a way to make these things happen, and we'll balance the budget or be fiscally responsible. Yes, there'll be new revenues.
Yeah.
And putting those things together, it's then our job to both negotiate that and implement that. And that has to be the mission. These jobs are a privilege, right? I'm honored to be in this administration. I'm really honored that he does. I developed a relationship with him.
I was going to ask you about that.
I developed a relationship with him in late winter. And so the primary was still going down. Everybody still thought he wasn't going to win. And we just had conversations about government and what you do in the different offices. And he is so incredibly thoughtful on these questions and probing and looking to understand, okay, doesn't know everything. What doesn't he know and how do we help effectuate policy? And I was both inspired by his campaign before and then meeting him and realizing the commitment he felt that didn't waver from. It was hard not to say, I will help you in any way I can. So whether that's inside or out, and then we kept meeting. We kept talking about policy. So it's a privilege to be part of this. And there are people walking by us out there who have struggled every single day. And he has put forward an agenda to address huge part of the problem they confront and make their life easier and make it so they can stay in the SIP and not leave the scene. But this city is affordable corridor. That's the agenda of hope is what's our obligation to do. And it's our privilege to do. So
stepping back into this role, does it feel familiar or does it feel different this time as well?
Well, it's a great question. It is different. Every period of time and challenge are different. And it's good. The way I view it is I need to take that experience both in New York City and in Albany, where I worked for years.
Zach.
Take that experience and use that, but it's not the motto. Right. It's a body of knowledge, but it's not the same. This is a different mayor for a different time with different challenges and different opportunities. So it's a good foundation, but no, it's going to be a different administration. So
you bring the institutional experience to that, but with a movement driven and ambitious mayor on board.
Yes.
We didn't talk a lot about what the first deputy mayor actually does. So I keep stopping you from having some tabbouleh. So after that question,
it's fine. And it's beautiful to look at too. So, and you're allowing me to sip coffee. And that's maybe the most important.
Exactly, anything you want.
So as we develop this transition, we need to structure a government that works for the mayor-elect, right? So what does that look like? And that's what's my role, what's his chief of staff, El Biscard Church, who we announced with me. It was part of that brilliant campaign. It was great we were announced together. Working with this incredible team that came through that election and now expanding it for the transition, we're going to figure out, okay, how to effectuate the change he wants and also keep things. I mean, there are day-to-day things that we have to make sure happen in New York. If there's a snowstorm, that has to happen, right? The roads have to stay clean. The garbage has to be picked up. The day-to-day operational things have to happen. So Our job is to figure out, okay, how do we structure the city differently? How do we structure City Hall so it's responding to the day-to-day? It's driving the policy. It's addressing anything that may happen in Washington that affects us. How do we address all those things at the same time so we don't get sidetracked? We stay on our principles. We stay on our policy. So the first deputy mayor role really is to make sure the operations of the government are moving forward. But again, I'm going to be part of conversations, not just about the budget, not just about labor contracts, not just about what agencies and how we decide their reporting, but what's happening in orbit, right? We had a meeting with the governor. Elle and I were both in that meeting. You would expect that, right? So we're going to be flexible enough to make sure that daily operational challenges are being met and the policy is being driven. So we're going to do that. And I'm going to have a team with me and we're going to make sure that those daily operations are occurring. So it's not a direct, it's sort of an answer of what a first deputy mayor does. But as we get closer to January 1st, we'll have that more defined, but we're also going to all be involved, all of us, that we agree with what the mayor-elect identified as the issues and the policies, and we're going to
ensure it is.
Right? That's a key to this.
That was clear throughout the campaign as well. It's definitely a continuation of that energy. Like a lot of the questions I want to ask you.
I'm preempting
them. And, you know, people want to hear from you directly. So instead of it being question answer, you gave your dynamic with Zohran. I want to ask you about that. So you're very clear about that, talking a bit about Governor Hochul as well. So I think it was a pretty full image. The one thing.
Anything you wanted?
I wanted to ask you was the nice thing about new media and podcasts and stuff like that is it doesn't always, the questions don't have to be like mainstream media all the time. So imagine if a year from now, a New Yorker is watching this podcast, what is one thing you want them to think? Oh, that thing Dean Flahan talked about, I saw the difference in that. I can actually feel that it's become better or changed. What would that one thing be?
That we started to address, that you see in a practical way, is a change in affordability. That something has, that things have started to change in New York City, and you feel that sense of hope. And you actually, it's a requirement that you feel, right? It's the one thing.
So
but
personal budget, and next year you'll be like, oh, okay,
yes.
I actually do have a bit more left from my budget.
That we've something that was constraining you and constraining that person, they now have relief.
Like childcare, if you have the young kids. Bus.
Okay. Free buses, childcare, rent.
That's the nice thing about
it. I mean, that's why the platform.
It's easily gaugeable.
But while that's what I hope you'll see, I also need to make sure that you say, you know what? You're also running a city. You're meeting the day-to-day operational things of the city of New York. So both those things have to happen. And if there are challenges, and there always are in a governor, and everybody talks about Washington and the president and... But whatever those challenges are, that we're addressing those too. Because I can't predict exactly what's going to happen at every single thing in the next year, but that we give you the comfort that you have in it. You have someone running New York City that's addressing those unforeseen challenges, and that we're doing it thoughtfully, but that it that we're still driving the agenda and we're still managing the city.
There's a lot of naysayers that keep saying Zohran's promises. He's giving promises to working class folks that he can't actually keep. Thanksgiving is around the corner, and it's a time when a lot of family members and loved ones come together. And
wonderful time.
They maybe don't see eye to eye.
Yes.
So I'm sure a lot of folks watching this, listening to this conversation, will have people on that table that are naysayers when it comes to what Zohran can actually deliver on. What would you tell those folks?
So it's good they're having a wonderful meal for it to calm down the political argument. The agenda, it's not, again, it's an agenda that the people of New York City support. They have shown that in unprecedented numbers.
Resoundingly, for sure.
And it's captured people who were not, and we talked about this earlier, who were not part of that system and now ours. It's about dividing the clear agenda of affordability, and it's it's a requirement of us to deliver on that. And I would say to them, judge us, of course, but we're going to show you that we can improve the lives of New Yorkers. And what part of that agenda seems inappropriate? Child care, universal child care. Helping 3 and 4 year olds in an early education system so everybody can afford it and not simply the wealthy. That there's equity in taxation while the very wealthiest are getting huge benefits out of Washington. That housing is not a serious crisis in of affordability. That free buses and faster, it doesn't help working people in New York. What part of that agenda is wrong? And because it's hard to imagine, what is the argument? The argument keeps coming back. Oh, you can't afford it. You can't do this. Well, we'll show me the candidate. Are the goals wrong? Hard to imagine they would say they are.
That was very useful when we were canvassing throughout the campaign, where a lot of the ideas people think are, you know, very unreasonable. But when you take the time to explain to them the way that it was broken down on the website or Zohran speaks, a lot of people would get on board. It's just that there was so much misinformation and an knee-jerk reaction where, like, this is the absolute best. Don't even think about having something better. But when you discuss it, like, point by point with folks, in my experience at least, it almost always works.
Yeah.
And even if they're, like, not on board or they're not, like, fully committed, they understand that that idea isn't that crazy. It's just that no one took the time to explain it to them. And I feel that is something really special about Zohran. Like, since I met him in 2021, I've, like, noticed that about him.
Wow, so, it's amazing.
Yeah. Deep Fehan, thank you so much.
You know, it was real pleasure. And you owe me, I think, a kibbe dinner, and maybe I owe you...
Should do. It's time. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie I fought. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm where I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know.